This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The Kenyan government is delaying its decision to close the huge Dadaab refugee camp, which houses nearly 300,000 people, most of them Somalis. But Kenya's interior minister insists the process to repatriate the Somalis will continue.
That's VOA's Mohammed Yusuf reporting. Details next.
Also, as the anti-corruption campaign in Nigeria continues with high-profile officials facing charges, activists worry that the campaign is becoming increasingly one-sided. And a 200-page study that identifies crimes committed in Burundi, including murder, kidnapping, torture, and mass detention, is being disputed by the government.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the Kenyan government is delaying its decision to close the huge Dadaab refugee camp, which houses nearly 300,000 people, most of them Somalis. But Kenya's interior minister insists the repatriation of the Somalis will continue. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Kenyan Interior Minister Joseph Nkaiseri said his country had postponed the closure of the Dadaab camp, currently home to more than 280,000 Somali refugees. Nkaiseri told reporters in Nairobi Wednesday the Kenyan government was responding to a request by the United Nations Refugee Agency UNHCR and Somali government not to close the camp.
I wish to announce that the government has accepted the request to extend the deadline for the completion of repatriation of Somali refugees and eventual closure of the Dadaab refugee complex by 6 months. However, the ongoing voluntary repatriation will continue uninterrupted.
The minister was joined by UNHCR officials and Somali government representatives. In May, Kenya's government announced it will shut down the Dadaab by November 30th. The camp was opened in 1991. When Somalia descended into civil war after the fall of the Mohamed Siad Barre regime. At one point, the sprawling camp held some 400,000 refugees. Kenyan security agencies repeatedly said the camp was a security threat, citing activity in the camp by the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. In recent months, tens of thousands of Somali refugees have returned home. However, most of the returnees say basic needs, such as food, shelter, clean water and schools, are not being met. Nkaiseri says the political and security situation in Somalia has led Kenya to reconsider their earlier decision.
The request for the extension was due to a very delicate situation in Somalia. The Somali government is undergoing election period, and there are quite a number of areas which has not been secured.
Al-Shabaab still controls many parts of South and Central Somalia and continues to fight forces of the government and the African Union force AMISOM, of which Kenya is a part. Somali ambassador to Kenya Jamal Mohamed Hassan says his country lacks the capacity to take back its citizens.
On the Somali side, I would like to tell the world that we are willing and ready to receive our people. All we are trying to do now is to make sure that the absorption capacity on the other side is increased and we prepare the grounds for them to come back.
When the new deadline to close the Dadaab comes in May of next year, Nkaiseri says Somalis who have not returned home will be sent to other refugee camps.
The closure of the Dadaab complex does not mean Kenya is not taking refugees anymore. We still have Kakuma. The United Nations High Commission for Refugees has other refugee camps spread all over the world. That is a program which will be considered.
Amnesty International released a statement that it welcomes the announcement to suspend the closure of the camp, but calls on the Kenyan government to end what it called the forceful repatriation. In the coming weeks, Kenya will host a special summit of the regional bloc IGAD to discuss the Somali refugee crisis and regional security. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The Nigerian president's anti-corruption campaign continues with high-profile officials facing charges. But activists worry that the campaign is becoming increasingly one-sided, accusing the president of targeting his political foes. Chika Oduwa reports from Abuja, where the former national security advisor appears in court today on money laundering charges.
It is another day in the ongoing trial of Nigeria's former national security advisor, Colonel Sambo Dasuki. Despite rulings from several courts granting him bail, Dasuki is being held by the Nigerian State Security Services. He has been charged with mismanaging more than $2 billion meant for purchasing military equipment for the fight against Boko Haram under former President Goodluck Jonathan. Dasuki is just one of several high-profile Nigerians who have been arrested as part of President Muhammadu Buhari's anti-corruption campaign over the past year. Last month, Jonathan's media advisor, Ruben Abati, was arrested by an anti-graft agency. The former journalist was later granted bail. Many people are being accused of money laundering and other forms of political corruption, but no one has been indicted. And people are beginning to wonder why.
What we have seen ongoing, some level of judicial conspiracy ongoing in the entire process. People going to court, getting bills, finding space to, you know, maneuver the judicial process.
Salahuddin Hashim works for a local nonprofit that partners with Transparency International to track government corruption. Hashim says there are problems with the way corruption cases are handled in Nigeria, including a lack of coordination between investigators and prosecutors. Perhaps the biggest issue, he says, is bribery.
Most importantly is the fact that our judicial process has become commercialized. So the highest bidder will always get the most comfortable side of justice.
About a dozen high-level Nigerian judges have now been accused of fraud and accepting bribes. State security officers have raided some of their homes in the past few weeks. Some people say judges have hampered the country's fight against corruption, but others think it is nothing more than a smear campaign targeting the president's own political opponents. A report from the Washington-based Pew Research Center that came out this week shows that most Nigerians believe that only a small number of elite citizens benefit from the government. It also said that 60% of Nigerians are optimistic that there will be less corruption in the future. Chika Oduwa in Abuja for VOA News.
Only 13% of the more than 1 million refugees who have settled in Germany in the past year have found a job. The German government and two research institutes conducted a survey to determine the nation's success in relocating migrants and refugees. Most have fled war and poverty in the Middle East and Africa. Many who have applied for refugee status have found limited access in finding work in Europe's largest economy. Another survey estimates about 70% will have jobs in 15 years. Also in Berlin, eight German nationals have been charged with the 2015 bombings of shelters housing refugees and the homes of Germans who support refugee integration. The eight are members of a group that threw explosives at facilities in Dresden, resulting in some injuries but no deaths. In related news, more than 180 Eritreans flew from Rome to Germany today, the first group of refugees being relocated from refugee centers in Italy. The International Office for Migration says in this year, more than 340,000 migrants and refugees have landed in Europe, mostly in Italy and Greece. More than 4,200 have been reported missing or dead trying to make the Mediterranean crossing.
In Burundi, government officials are disputing a new report issued this week by the International Federation of Human Rights. The 200-page study identifies crimes committed in the country committed since April 2015, primarily by security forces and youth militias of the ruling party. The report documents a number of extrajudicial crimes, including murder, kidnapping, torture, and mass detention, and alleges the involvement of high-ranking officials. From Bujumbura, reporter Moses Javierimana has the story.
This is not the first time an international organization has accused the Burundi security officials or the ruling party's youth wing in Imbonerakure of violating human rights. It's also not the first time the government has denied these charges. Jean-Claude Karegwa is the deputy spokesman of President Pierre Nkurunziza.
This is what I can call deja vu. So these organizations are always trying to tarnish the image of Burundi. So it's part of a campaign, a media hype against the government and the people of Burundi. Facts are facts. Whoever needs to know what's going on in Burundi should come to Burundi and find out firsthand.
Officials of the International Federation of Human Rights, OIFHR, says they did just that. They say the study was done over the course of 24 months through investigative missions and permanent monitoring of the political and human rights situation. The IFHR warns that there is potential for genocide. Both the opposition and the government say the crisis in Burundi is political and not ethnic. And Karewa says impunity by those committed abuses will not be tolerated.
To be honest with you, nobody can say that everything is all right in Burundi. In Burundi, as any other countries of the world, there are some crimes, there are some mistakes, but responsibility lies on different groups in Burundi, the opposition, the police. But as far as the government is concerned, whoever has been found guilty of any crime is now being prosecuted and punished.
The report says the government has set up a propaganda organs and tools which broadcast an ideology that's pro-Hutu, the largest ethnic group in the country. Leonce Kumana is a leader of FRODEBU, an opposition party in Burundi. He says, however, that the violence is not based on ethnicity and that both Hutu and Tutsi groups have been targeted.
Pour nous, les crimes ont été commis par le pouvoir et ses services contre les manifestants.
He says that crimes were committed by the regime and its institutions against those who protested the incumbent president's third term in the office, which they say it is illegal. Ngenakumana says the violence is also against those who support the Arusha Agreement, which ended years of civil war and also limited presidents to two terms in the office. He says he doesn't think genocide is imminent and that protesters have been from both Hutu and Tutsi ethnic groups. The opposition leader says that members of political parties and civil society organizations and journalists have all been targeted, as well as all those who protested against the third term. The government says the country is regaining calm after more than a year of protests and instability that claimed more than 1,000 lives. However, the international community says the country remains unstable, and the US has released a travel warning to Americans visiting the country. Moses Javierimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
19 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Even though malaria-carrying mosquitoes are becoming more resistant to insecticides, chemically treated bed nets still offer significant protection against the disease. That's the finding of a 5-year study released today at the annual meeting of the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene in Atlanta. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The World Health Organization, with funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, conducted the study in Benin, Cameroon, Kenya, Sudan, and India. It looked at the effectiveness of what are called long-lasting insecticidal nets. WHO scientist Dr. Tessa Knox helped evaluate them.
The main outcome from the study was very positive. It basically indicated that the long-lasting nets that are being used all throughout sub-Saharan Africa are actually still working. That was a very critical finding to show that we really do need to proceed with this scale-up of nets and make sure that everybody who's living in at-risk areas is sleeping under a net and using the net correctly.
But if mosquitoes have a resistance to the chemicals in bed nets, how do they provide significant protection against malaria?
So a mosquito could land on a net, and while it wouldn't die immediately, what it would do is continue to search on the net for a hole so that it can penetrate and go underneath and bite the person beneath the net. In the process of searching on the net, it contacts the net surface and absorbs insecticide. And as it absorbs that insecticide, it would eventually take on a lethal dose, which would kill that mosquito. So even if they don't die immediately, the searching process would mean that eventually they may die.
Nevertheless, Knox says there's still an urgent need for new and improved malaria-fighting tools.
Some of these tools that have recently been evaluated are things like new insecticides or new formulations that combine more than one insecticide. Also looking at genetic manipulation of the mosquitoes that can be released, which would basically change the structure of a mosquito population in an area and reduce its ability to transmit malaria. But at the moment and in the near future, we anticipate insecticidal nets will continue to be the mainstay of malaria prevention.
At a study site in Sudan, researchers sprayed the walls of homes with an insecticide that differed from chemicals used in bed nets. They say that reduced infections by an additional 50% compared with using long-lasting insecticidal nets alone. Dr. Knox says insecticides used against malaria should not cause any ill effects in people.
All of the chemicals that are being applied broadly across sub-Saharan Africa have been through a very strict safety testing to get the WHO recommendation that would allow their usage. So there aren't any concerns with the current insecticides that have been using in the nets, nor are there concerns with the sprays that are being used on the wall, if they're being used in the correct way.
The World Health Organization calls long-lasting insecticidal nets the cornerstone of malaria control efforts in sub-Saharan Africa, which shoulders 90% of the global malaria burden. It says availability of the nets in this region rose from 2% in the year 2000 to 53% in 2015. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Many teachers in Zimbabwe have decided to quit their profession after being laid off or not paid. Desperate for a reliable income, some teachers have become street vendors, a career path often looked down upon in Zimbabwe. Others have left to look for work in neighboring countries. Reporter Kudze Zivenvashi has more on the story from Harare.
In these troubling economic times, most teachers have left the profession, opting for vending, where they sell wares that range from cell phone accessories, second-hand clothes, and prepaid top-up cards for cell phones, locally known as airtime. Executive Director of the Vendors Initiative for Social and Economic Transformation, Samuel Wadzai, says there has been an increase in the number of teachers that have left teaching for the informal sector in Zimbabwe.
We have had quite a number of teachers leaving the profession to join the informal sector, in particular vending. You know, the government has been failing to pay the civil servants in time.
The government of Zimbabwe has laid off some public school teachers to reduce its annual payroll of government employees. Wadzai says classroom teachers have been targeted and pushed out of their jobs by the job audit that was meant to root out ghost workers from the government payroll.
We have recently had that audit really targeted teachers, and the majority of them were left stranded when they were fired from work. So naturally, they decided to join the informal sector, and that has really seen our organization growing in terms of its membership. And in as much as we call for the government to ensure that they support the sector, we feel that the way that they have treated some of our members who are teachers is not welcome. So we call upon the government to ensure that everything that they do is in the laws of this country.
Joseph Kukapura is one such case of a teacher who left his dream job after 7 years for vending, after he realized he couldn't build a life for himself and his extended family from the profession.
I quit teaching in 2008. There's a job that makes your life very difficult. Sometimes you don't get paid, you don't know when you get getting paid, and if you get paid, you cannot access your money. So that's why I left.
Vending in Zimbabwe is somewhat criminalized, and the job comes with its own challenges.
You know, vending, you're always at odds with the police. You're not secure. Sometimes your goods get confiscated. Sometimes you get arrested. So it's really tough. I actually don't wish to go back to teaching.
Kokapura remembers enrolling at the teachers' college and thinking he was on his pathway to fulfilling his dream. But fast forward to date, teaching is no longer a dream job for anyone. Kokapura says challenges are there, but it's better than the civil service.
If you look at the civil servants right now, they cannot even access their cash.
Just last year, over 3,000 teachers were struck off the government payroll. More teachers have voluntarily left the classroom in search for more rewarding opportunities. Zimbabwe has been experiencing an acute cash crisis, which has seen long queues of civil servants at banks trying to access their money. They are hindered by daily withdrawal limit and bank charges, which have effectively and unofficially cut their meager salary. The government has decided to introduce bond notes, a surrogate local currency that will be equivalent to the US dollar that has been in use in the country since 2009. This is Kudzai Nawashe reporting for Voice of America from Harare.
Recent interracial police shootings across the United States and the protests that followed have reopened old wounds and highlighted racial inequalities in American society. Now, a documentary movie aimed primarily at young people attempts to open a dialogue on the issues surrounding this most sensitive area of American culture. VOA's Jeff Custer spoke with one of the film's creators, as well as students who have seen the film.
Race has always been there. People need to see that. Instead of ignoring it and trying to be like, there's no segregation, there's no slavery, it's still here though, and people need to know.
The film, I'm Not Racist, Am I?, follows 12 New York City high school students over 9 months as they participate in exercises and sometimes difficult discussions that directly address the bias they deal with on a daily basis, not in theaters. The film is being shown exclusively to groups of young people and their parents. The film's director, Katherine Wigginton Green, says parents tend to find the film especially challenging.
They're really seeing that, you know, kids maybe are going to dances or have friends with kids who are different race, and so they think, oh, they just have it all figured out. But what we realized in making the film is that kids don't, and they're not talking about it with their families.
The film has been screened repeatedly at Woodrow Wilson High School, a large multicultural public school in Washington, D.C. Principal Kimberly Martin says her students needed to see it.
From the first day that I was in this school, I could not believe that there are classrooms that are all African American or all Latino, and then there are classrooms that are all white.
Student James Sorokin agreed that a diverse school population does not necessarily translate to racial integration.
I think that, honestly, like, white kids hang out with white kids here and black kids hang out with black kids generally.
The film convinced student Amilcar Hudson that talking about racial issues like self-segregation is the best way to address them. But he acknowledges that talking about race remains a challenge.
I mean, I think that's the scariest part about it. I understand that there's a racial problem in this country, but the fact that people don't really feel comfortable talking about it means that we're almost subconsciously satisfied with it, and we're okay with this going on.
I understand it's so hard to hear that you are inherently racist because of something you can't control, but isn't it worse to hear that you are less than people inherently because of the color of your skin?
Students at Wilson High have formed a group called Common Ground to encourage interaction and discussion among students of different cultural backgrounds. Jeff Custer, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll examine Beyond the Storm, treating the powerless and the powerful in Mobutu's Congo Zaire, a book written by Dr. William Close and Dr. Matudila Malonga, a Congolese physician who co-discovered Ebola in 1976, will also discuss the latest developments in the Democratic Republic of Congo on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.